And good morning, and thanks for joining us here on Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Renee Bodley. Three Park City School Board seats are up for election. Districts 1, 2, and 3. We'll be talking with Andrew Kaplan and Peter Yogman first. We'll be taking your phone calls at about 10:30. So if you do have questions, please wait till then, and you can call those in at 435-655-8255. Coming up later on in the hour, 20 of Utah's 29 counties began using the vote-by-mail system in June's primary, a new experience for Summit County. Wasatch County has been doing it. We'll be talking to the man who is in charge of that, Mark Thomas. He is the state elections director for the Lieutenant Governor's Office. All of that coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
Do you have an old car, RV, or boat taking up space in your yard? Donate it to KPCW. You'll receive a tax credit, and we receive a donation. We'll take care of everything. Just call 435-649-9004. Thank you for your support.
And welcome back to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host here, Renee Bodley. Three Park City School Board seats are up for election this year, Districts 1, 2, and 3. Phil Kaplan is running unopposed in District 1 after candidate Greg Greer dropped out of the race a few weeks ago. The candidates for District 2 joining us in the studio this morning. Welcome to Andrew Kaplan and Peter Yogman.
Hi, Leslie.
Hello. Peter? Good morning.
We're going to start with opening statements. Each of you will have 60 seconds to explain to our listeners who you are and why you're the best man for this job. Peter, we'll start with you.
Great. Thank you very much. I want to start with what I think this election is about and what I think it's really not about. I don't think this election really is about who cares more about schools. I know Andrew has a child entering kindergarten, and he cares deeply about schools, but all candidates care deeply. We wouldn't go through this without that deep sense of obligation to this community. I have dear friends with kids in school from kindergarten through high school. There are members of the board with kids in schools. I think this is really a distinction without a difference. So I want to focus on is what's important in this election, and I think that is who is best equipped to move us forward, to set priorities, and bring this community together. And I think I have the skills and the character and the dedication to do that and to establish an effective process, which is clarity, collaboration with all stakeholders in this community, and sensitivity to what the schools do to this community. And that would include things like experience, dedication, creativity, and we can talk further on all of those issues.
Thank you, Peter. Andrew.
Sure, thanks. I'm Andrew Kaplan. I'm running for school board because I have a strong desire and commitment to serve our community's children. I believe the role of the school board is to listen to parents, voters, and educators and do what's best and most innovative for our children in Park City. My family's community involvement has been a priority since moving to Park City full-time 4 years ago. I've been on the board of the Park City Education Foundation for 4 years. I'm responsible for managing their cash and endowment investments. I also serve as treasurer of the Park City Film Series. My wife is on the board of the Community Foundation and is board president of EATS, which is Eat Awesome Things at School. We have two young children. One's in nursery school and one who's in kindergarten at Parley's. And the fact that my children are going to be in the school district for the next 15 years leaves me uniquely and strongly committed to ensuring our district continues to strive for excellence. Thanks.
Peter, I'm going to start with you. You were one of those a year ago, very much against the bond that was floated a year ago. And I'm thinking the reason you're running may be because of that process that you found yourself involved with.
Sure.
Here we are, though, a year later, and what's really changed? I mean, treasure still needs to come down. We still need more room for high school athletics and performing arts. We need a place to put two grades, at the very minimum, the eighth grade if treasure comes down. And with preschool and all-day kindergarten taking up extra space at the elementary schools, we'll need a fifth grade. So again, what's changed? And we still need to bond, and all we've done is just delay what needs to be done.
You know, I am totally for a bond, and I think this community needs to understand all of the type of spending that we're going to have to face going forward. I oppose the bond more than for just the particulars. I oppose the bond for what I thought it did to our community. And let me give you three quick examples. First of all, I thought if we had passed this bond, it meant our community would have accepted a broken process, a process where decisions were made behind closed doors, pushed out to the community. This isn't just my opinion. This is the opinion of the business manager who gave this talk to the board when they were asking why the bond failed. I don't think we should allow a broken process to occur in our public institutions. I think if this bond had passed, it would have meant that we would have accepted not having the clear understanding of what the implications of some of these programs were. For instance, I'm going to give you an example of the 5-6 school. And this was actually referenced on the school website, some of these articles. There are real downsides to a 5-6 middle type school, and we should know those. It should be part of our discussion. And the fact that these weren't discussed means that this community would have made a decision without complete information. That's why I really emphasize clarity and completeness. And finally, the bond would have said that we as a community want glitz over substance. I mean, a new football field didn't even make sense. And we say it didn't cost very much, $5 million more than refurbishing the field. But that's the start of fiscal irresponsibility. And it's more than just the money. You know, maybe the money isn't that much, but it's about the land that we have and how we use it, because this is some of the second most valuable resource we have in this town is our land after our people. So I think we need to look at how we're going to prioritize the use of that land before we so cavalierly spread out across the Kearns campus. So there are very, very good reasons why the bond didn't pass, but I think we're moving forward to pass a tremendous bond. I was just at the high school expansion committee, and I am really thrilled with the work they're doing. Absolutely thrilled.
Andrew, I want to talk to you. You are a member, or still maybe a member, of the Park City Education Foundation, which goes to pay for a lot of the programs offered within the Park City school districts. Mm-hmm. Given that, were you just going along with what the board had to do last year with in terms of the bond? I mean, something you supported and like, yeah, they know best?
No, I did vote for the bond as a citizen and as a voter. And, you know, I did that because I looked at the individual cost to me and my family as taxpayers, and I felt that the tax increase was modest enough that it was worth improving the facilities for our children. Did I love everything about the bond? No. Did I think that things could have been done better? Yes. Do I agree that with, you know, certain of the people who dissented on the bond, that the numbers didn't add up or quote unquote smell right? Yeah, I would kind of agree with that. And I didn't go along with it because, you know, just because I'm very positive on education and pro education in town. But I think that, you know, politics and, you know, being on the school board and being, you know, being a part of this community is all about compromise. And I think, unfortunately, you know, as you pointed out, here we are a year later and we still have the same problems with our facilities. You know, if you go to our elementary schools, they're still very crowded. We have trailers at Trailside. We have, you know, Treasure looks like Grand Central during, you know, during class changes. And now we're just a year further behind in terms of building new facilities and getting these things done so that our students have a good place to learn.
One of the points that Peter just made is that we had a broken process. And again, that's something I think I have heard people point to, you know, that there was this lack of confidence in the process to build consensus. So how, if elected, how do you create consensus among such a diverse community?
Yeah, so I would disagree that the process is broken. I think, you know, calling anything broken is very dangerous. I think, was the process perfect? No. But what I think is important is that we have a wonderful community. We have great parents who are involved and care. We have great students and we have good educators. And I think what needs to happen is more communication. And I think the district has started to recognize that and move in that direction. I think that, you know, the town and people have gotten more involved in this process. There's been a lot of committees, you know, like the one that Peter mentioned about the high school expansion. There's been a lot of involvement from people who dissented on the board. And I think, you know, the process this time around is going is going to have more consensus as a result. How would I do it? Look, I'm a manager. I've been a manager at large corporations. I have my own business now. I'm familiar with dealing with a lot of different personalities and trying to compromise to get things accomplished for the greater good. And I think that I have that skill set, and I'll bring that with me when elected.
Now, you mentioned, Peter, that you didn't like the idea of a 5-6 school. Mm-hmm. Should Park City School District build a new elementary school so that elementary schools can be K-6? And if so, where? On land owned near Kimball Junction or another 5-6 school?
I think we really need to have all of the information out there so we can make an informed decision. I mean, I read deeply into literature, and a 5-6 school, we know what happens. Academic standards drop. Behavioral issues go up, including high-risk behaviors, okay? I mean, I know a lot of people who have children that have struggled on a dark path, and almost always that began in middle school. So I would prefer a K-6 school. There are a couple of places. I mean, I think Mo has mentioned across from Parley's. We have land at Silver Creek. We know we have land at Ecker if we can move that school further away from the 7-8 school. So there are a lot of options that we can look at in terms of where a pre-K-6 school could go.
Andrew, turn my mic on. Andrew, do you have an idea for?
Yeah, a couple things. I would say both, right? I think one, we do need another elementary school because our elementary schools are crowded and we have more and more families moving to town. And, you know, I recognize the reasons that we haven't built one in the past, but, you know, now we are behind the eight ball in terms of our capacity for elementary. And so one, I would say we need a new elementary school. Two, you know, I do support the 5-6 school, and I support that because I think that is best for curriculum, and especially around DLI. And I think that it's important to, you know, continue that program. I think that, you know, the idea of having a 5th-6th school remain in a sort of an elementary curriculum is sensible. And, you know, what I'd say is that we can all read a lot of research on the internet. We can all do a lot. But ultimately, this is Park City, and we need to listen to our community, and we need to listen to parents, and we need to listen to our educators. And I think that to ignore the input from voters and to come in with preconceived notions based on, you know, research that's read on the internet is a very dangerous thing. When we're elected, we're elected to represent the voters' interests. We're not elected to preach what we've read on the internet and what academic articles we've read. That's an important input, but, you know, when elected, I'm not going to be bringing preconceived notions about policy. What I'll be doing is listening to the voters and representing their views.
And Peter, you wanted to add to that?
It's not the internet. I actually talk to the professors at Harvard and Columbia who do these studies. So let's not demean what is actually going on. And what I think is, as part of a process, we need to be fully informed from all sources, whether it's our administration, whether it's people who have actually studied this. I think clarity on all of the issues is important. And if we don't have, let's treat this community like the educated adults that they are. And let's give them all the input that they need to make these decisions. In terms of DLI, you know, the 5-6 school versus a K-6 school, it doesn't affect DLI. DLI is currently in the elementary schools. If you added a sixth grade with an additional elementary school or schools, it transitions perfectly into the next grade. So, you know, I know there's been some disinformation, I think, about DLI, and I think all the candidates are fully supportive of this program, and the only thing that I've offered is to reunite schools a little bit stronger by centering the whole community around language and offering conversational language classes to those people not in DLI because parents are feeling left out.
Andrew, do you have anything you want to add to that?
With regards to DLI?
Yeah,
look, I'm fully supportive of the program. I think that there has been some questions around funding and support by current board members and candidates. And look, I think the community as a whole does support it. And I think for the most part, candidates do support it. But it's a very unique offering that our community has, and it's very special. And to me, the only debate is that, you know, how far does it go? You know, does it go through high school? Does it go, or, you know, do we follow the McPolin model, which is very successful for that community? Which is, you know, full dual language immersion in the school. And I think that's, you know, that's a topic that's open for debate.
Let's move on to another topic, start times. How do you feel, Andrew, about having the older students start later, especially if it means our younger students having to wait for a school bus in the dark?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. I was at that meeting, and I think that the science that was presented and the study that was presented by the work study committee was very solid. And I think that they made a very good point that, you know, especially adolescents need to start later. What I was a bit disappointed about was the process that the decision was made under, and that, you know, the input from educators and from families of students who were in the younger grades, namely the elementary and the lower middle school, wasn't really taken before the decision was made. And that's important because what's going to happen is there's going to be a cost to moving this. And either we're going to need more buses to start our elementary and lower middle school children later as well, or we're going to need to increase funding for aftercare programs, because there's a lot of working families that rely on older kids to take care of their younger siblings when they come home. And to have, you know, a six-year-old or a five-year-old waiting for the bus, you know, in the dark, in the middle of the winter, and then coming home at 1:30 in the afternoon, there's a lot of problems that arise from that on both ends of the timing. So, you know, I support everyone starting later. I don't support what that means if it means that, you know, elementary and the lower middle schools start much, much earlier.
Yeah. Peter, how do you feel about changing the start times?
High school should start later. The evidence of this from all kinds of studies say that the biological clock of teenagers is shifted approximately 2 hours. And in terms of academic performance and health and all other measures, students do much better in high school if they start later. And yes, I have heard a lot of pushback from the elementary school parents, and I think we need to accommodate them. And I'm going to say, I heard Julie Eyhausen, because I go to all the meetings, say, you know, there might be an elegant solution here. If kids are more awake when they go to school, maybe if we just cut 5 minutes off each of those seven periods, we could accommodate both shifting the elementary schools or keeping them where they are at about 8:15 and moving the high school and being able to solve all these transportation problems. So there, I think there are some elegant solutions that can accommodate everybody, but this is up to the implementation committee to do it. The only other thing I think is important is we need to have a deadline for implementing this, which should be the start of the 17-18 school year.
That's when we should start, or that's when it should be done?
That's when we should have all the time shifted. We can't let this drag out. It's too important.
You're listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW Radio. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Renee Bodley. We're talking with the candidates for school board district number 2, Andrew Kaplan and Peter Yogman. We'll be back right after this.
Egyptian Theater presents Park City Follies Rewind, a retrospective recap of the last 16 years of Follies, from inception through mayhem, narrated by Tom Clyde, Tuesday and Wednesday this week. Egyptian Theater also presents Otmar Liebert and Luna Negra, 5-time Grammy nominees with over 38 gold and platinum recordings, in a world tour of musical styles and instruments Thursday through Saturday this week. All shows at 8 p.m. All tickets at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This Lost and Found report is brought to you in part by Realtor Julie Hopkins at jhparkcity.com, 901-0616. Park City Title Company, providing escrow services in Summit and Wasatch Counties, 649-8322. And Intermountain Mortgage Company, local lending solution since 1992, 649-6660.
Wasatch and Wool Yarns is delighted to continue sponsoring KPCW's Classified Show. They offer yarn and fiber for knitting, spinning, weaving, and crochet. A few of the brands they carry include Blue Sky Alpacas, Noro, Malabrigo, and The Fiber Company. They also have classes for all abilities and monthly knit-alongs. Wasatch & Wool at the Redstone Shopping Center, wasatchandwool.com.
Welcome back to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley with my co-host, Leslie Thatcher. We're joined this morning with the candidates for District 2. We have Andrew Kaplan and Peter Yogman in studio with us. We've been talking about start times. We've been talking about school bonds. Now we're going to hit a big topic, a topical topic, drug testing. Peter, we'll start with you. What is the school's role in drug education and enforcement?
Look, the school has the role of a parent when the kids are in school. So the school does have a large role in this. We have those kids there for a good part of the day. And I think if you're referring to the drug testing issue, I think this could be a valid path, but I am not ready to go down that path till I hear from all stakeholders, parents, students, teachers, because we need to, if we do this, we need to make sure that we're not just imposing another top-down solution where we haven't heard from all of the people who could be affected by this. I just want to pivot to another solution that maybe could be done in conjunction, and that is there's some great programs out there. They're starting in Canada. They're starting in Europe, where we can start to identify psychologically kids who are susceptible to addiction. And by early intervention, and I think with the permission of parents, the results are absolutely fantastic. With cutting the addiction through targeted counseling to these young kids so that when they feel the pressure later on, they know how to deal with their particular personality types and avoid this dark path that so many kids are going down.
Peter, how do you feel about drug testing?
Andrew.
Excuse me.
That's all right. Look, I think it's, we have a community problem, which is not too dissimilar to other communities in this country, and especially around opioids and abuse of opioids. And I think that, drug testing in schools is nothing new. It's, it's been passed by the Supreme Court that schools have the right to do that. My understanding is that students can be drug tested if they're involved in after-school activities, and that's the limitation, unless there's a strong suspicion of drug use, in which case the school has the right to do that. So it's not, whether or not the school has the right, they do. To me, is it the school's responsibility, and does the school district want to pay for this? And, at the expense of other things, such as other educational programs around drug abuse. And I don't know that I do support it. I think that drug testing for me is up to the parent. I think that if there's a strong suspicion of drug use, the school should be searching lockers. The school does have the right to test students, but to test people who are on sports teams and to do that, the studies have shown that doesn't necessarily have a positive effect. And in this community, I think we have very educated students and very educated parents, and I'd like to see more programs and educational programs being done for drug prevention rather than spending that money on random drug tests of students.
You're listening to Utah Politics Now. In about 5 minutes, we'll take your questions at 655-8255. We'll welcome those. Let's move on to teachers. If elected, one of you will be responsible for negotiating a new contract with our teachers, both classified and licensed employees. Maybe just talk a little bit about your experience in negotiating. I mean, do you have that background? I mean, are you going to be a good representative for who, taxpayers or the teachers?
Sure. So, in my career, I've worked as a manager at large corporations and banks. I also run my own company now where, as a result, I'm the de facto HR director. So I definitely have experience in terms of negotiations of salaries and things like that. And look, the salary component is only one aspect to job satisfaction. And I think almost more important than that is that teachers feel that they're supported by the community and that they're supported by their administration. And I think that is, something that we need to continue to push forward and work on as a district, because that will help us retain and attract new teachers. With regards to salary negotiations, look, I think I will be neutral. I am a taxpayer, but I also recognize that, we need to pay our teachers and we have a teacher shortage. And this is something that I've talked about from the beginning and that I've been criticized for, by my opponent, especially in the primary, for bringing this up as a topic. There is nothing more important in our district as an asset than our educators and our teachers. And we need to be innovative. We need to make sure that they're getting what they need. Maybe the benefits package needs to be tweaked for certain younger teachers so that they can get more cash and less, less healthcare benefits. Perhaps we can look at things like student loan relief. The average teacher with a master's degree here is coming in and making $50,000 a year, and they have hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt. Well, our community is wonderful and it's inviting and people want to live here, but it's also unaffordable. And perhaps if we can do some things as a community to make it more affordable to attract educators from around the country, that would be an advantage for us. So look, I propose everything on the table. I want to meet with the teachers and the teachers union or the teachers association, I should say, and work with them to create innovative solutions. And I think it's our top priority for the next year.
All right. Well, Peter, we'll let you have that again. But the question being, I mean, did you have the experience to negotiate? And I mean, who do you root for here?
Who do I root for?
Teachers or the taxpayer?
Let me just start this way. Andrew says I was negative on him. Andrew proposed in the paper that we raise teachers' salaries aggressively, that we pay off loans, and that we increase housing stipends. My concern was when you say those kind of things, you could undermine the authority of the board to negotiate a very delicate contract. And even more importantly, you could undermine the ability of teacher representatives to market a contract to teachers, whatever they negotiate. So what I like to focus on is fixing the culture so that teachers feel part of the process. I mean, we did a strategic survey, and teachers were right now unhappy. So we need to make them part of this process so that they feel appreciated. And when teachers are enthusiastic about this district, we'll be a district that you know, brings in talent. And the second thing, in terms of the teacher housing issue, I mean, we really don't yet have a seat at the table with the county or the city in terms of attainable housing. And I really think that's the way we have to go, especially for new teachers, to give them that opportunity to live in town. Teachers who've been here for a while, they own houses, but we're seeing a disturbing trend of newer teachers not being able to live in town. I've worked with the Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust and Scott Loomis, and I think we have some really exciting plans. I think there's land available around some of the peripheries of schools where we can put some teacher housing, and we can make this an incredible community for teachers to want to work in.
Thank you. That's Peter Yeogman, and we have Andrew Kaplan also here, our candidates for District 2 for Park City School Board. We are taking your calls now. Call 435-655-8255, and we have a caller now.
Yep, we're going to ask you to put your headphones on so you can hear the question here. Caller, go ahead. You're on the line.
Thank you, Leslie and Renee. My name's Chuck Klingenstein, and someone very familiar with the commitment to an elected position. I would like to thank both of you candidates for offering yourselves as a potential member of the Park City School Board. One of the measures I use in evaluating a candidate's preparation for the position and the time commitment to the position is attendance of the past year or so of school board meetings and other school district functions. I am looking for a member who is ready to hit the ground running, already immersed in the policies, budgets, expenditures, state legislative issues, master planning, district issues, etc., and has already demonstrated a time commitment to the position. Please tell me about your preparation and time commitment to date.
Chuck, I need to hire you as a question writer, but I think we started with you. Let's start with you this time, Peter.
Sure. I have been to every school board meeting, some of them lasting 6 hours, except for one when I was traveling, since March, since I declared my candidacy. I've also been to pretty much every single work session, also lasting many hours, some starting at 9:30 in the morning. I have been over at the district office numerous times and spent time with people like Todd Hauber and Lori Pierce and Amber Conley. I've been toward the schools, the high school, the junior high, Treasure Mountain, and I've met with principals multiple times, people like Bob Edmonston and Dave Gomez, and long conversations with Sean Keenan. So I have reviewed the budget in detail. I've reviewed Utah regulations, and I have, yes, gone through the internet and read up on the topics of great concern, and I am ready and willing and able to hit the ground running. I mean, I think it was Woody Allen who said 90% of life is showing up. Well, I think I'm meeting that criteria.
All right. Andrew Kaplan, what's been your record?
Sure. So for the last 4 years, I've been on the board of the Education Foundation, which provides about a quarter of the discretionary budget to the school system. In that process, I've been involved in teacher grants, school grants, district grant committees. I am familiar with the majority of the programs that the school offers. I'm aware of the program's limitations. I'm aware of how the school is funded. In addition to that, I've spent time, you know, again, like Peter, at the district office, at the schools, meeting with principals, meeting with teachers, attending school board meetings, attending community meetings. So, you know, I have the ability, you know, fortunately enough to be working full time, but because I own my own business, you know, the ability to, you know, have a flexible work schedule and spend time with parents, with educators, you know, and during the week, during the school day, after school hours, et cetera. And, you know, I'll continue that schedule, you know, when elected.
Peter, you were shaking your head no.
I've been to every school board meeting but one. I haven't seen Andrew at one yet. I just wanted to say that's my observation. Maybe he's been there in the back row, but he's a pretty distinctive guy.
Okay. You're listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW. Again, we're taking your phone calls at 435-655-8255 for school board candidates Peter Yogman and Andrew Kaplan.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by DeJoria Center at High Star Ranch. Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, ESCO. And Cushman Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate.
Federal, state, and local taxes will be dramatically impacted as a result of the 2016 election. HCVT is pleased to sponsor KPCW's newest program, Utah Politics Now, to keep you informed about the candidates and issues. More business and personal tax information can be found at hcvt.com.
Hi, I'm landscape architect Seth Bockholt, sponsor of This Green Earth on KPCW. Bockholt offers project management for site and landscape environments from vision to creation. We're at the corner of Kearns Boulevard in the Reed Building, 649-3856.
And welcome back to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Renee Bodley. We want to get to closing statements, but I want to ask one more question before we move on to Mark Thomas with the Utah State Elections Office. PC Caps, guys, this is a program that started out strong, kind of fell off, and now just not even knowing what it wants to be. I mean, at one time we were talking about building a $5 million PC Caps building. Where do you stand on PC Caps? Let me see. I think it's your turn, Andrew, to go first.
Sure. Look, I think it's a wonderful program. I'm disappointed in the what's happened. You know, I think when the coordinator left, that was an important juncture in the program. And look, I think it's emblematic of what's happening in the district, where there's a lot of administration that's kind of going away, and that's by design. You know, the school board made a decision that all of the dollars needed to go into the classroom and away from administration. And as a result, we're losing administrators and coordinators of programs, and we're not hiring them for other things that are necessary, in my opinion. But, you know, what's a shame is that we do very well as a district, I think, in supporting certain tracks of education, such as the AP track. And we are not doing a lot in terms of, you know, things like hands-on and project learning, which is a shame because there's, you know, that's an exciting part of education and it's an innovative part of education. So PC Caps is a wonderful program. I support it. I think that it needs to continue to be funded. I think it's a mistake to integrate it fully into the rest of the curriculum. I think it was a mistake to let a lot of the advisors and the outside technical advisors go. You know, I think that we also as a community need to provide other outlets for students who don't necessarily learn in the classroom or don't want to go on to college, you know, and we're fortunate enough to have a five-star hospitality business in town. And I think that's another place to start. You know, if you talk to anyone who works at Montage or Stein's, the amount of job fairs that they need to do to staff their hotels isn't ridiculous. And they would love to have, you know, to sponsor and pay for programs here in town where they can get students to go directly to work for them.
So it sounds like you would support Principal Bob O'Connor's request to hire a PC Caps coordinator.
Oh, 100%.
Peter, how do you feel about the Caps program?
I think the PC Caps program has incredible potential, but we need to rethink it because right now it stands, you know, divided between the kids who are in the AP program, don't have time for it, and other kids who think it's too hard. I think it represents an R&D center for our entire school system because education is transforming into more project-based and hands-on learning. And what I would do, and this is just for exploration, is I would think about making that PC Caps program a full-time program, not just a period or two. And this is where kids, we could experiment with the entire hands-on learning project-based model, which is going into so many forward-thinking schools, but this is where we could try it out. This is where we could attract a lot more kids into being interested in this program, and then it would provide us with the data we need to see how we can expand this type of learning to other schools as appropriate.
Okay, you've been listening to the candidates for District Number 2, Peter Yogman and Andrew Kaplan.
We'll go now to closing statements. You'll each have 30 seconds each. Peter Yogman, since you started off with opening statements, we'll let you start with closing statements as well. So, Andrew Kaplan, you will get the last word. Peter Yogman, we're starting with you.
Thank you. I'm going to do two things. First, I just want to say that if you look at my experience, I've had two kids that went through the whole Park City school system. I think that's really important because if you're going to have a vision about schools, you have to know what schools are and what they're about, and you have to have that experience in all grades. I think I've already talked to you about my dedication in terms of looking at creative problem solving, whether I've come up with a plan to move the ninth grade faster and get the pressure off of Treasure. I've come up with ideas to coordinate preschools. That's such an important program. But finally, I just want to give a shout out, not about me, but to all the people that have dedicated so much time in bringing me up to speed. And that's, you know, Todd Hauber, McConnell, Lori Pierce at the administrative office, Bob Edmonston, Sean Keenan, Dave Gomez, the principals, and Bob O'Connor and Emily Sutherland for touring those schools with me. So thank you very much. I appreciate your hard work, dedication, and the time you've spent.
Andrew, that was more like a minute, so why don't you take the same amount of time?
Sure. Look, I'm excited about the election. I encourage everyone who cares about education to come out and vote in November. And I'm a listener, and I'm someone who is really, really interested in serving and dedicated to serving. And if you have any questions for me about my policies or you want to talk, you know, you can call me. I have a Facebook page, which is Andrew Kaplan for School Board. You can reach out to me on there, and I'll get in touch with you. I'm happy to swing by, have a coffee, or talk on the phone. And then lastly, what I'd like to say is today Whole Foods is being kind enough to donate 5% of their proceeds of their sales to Eats, which is a nonprofit in town which supports our children and is very important to my family and I. So if you have some time today, go out to Whole Foods, spend some money, support the kids. Thanks.
Okay. And I'm just going to say, put out their district to voters. Very lucky. We have two smart, articulate, caring candidates. So good luck to both of you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Celebrate fall and the arts on Saturday, October 15th from noon to 5 p.m. at the Kimball Arts Center. Arttoberfest is free and includes family activities like pumpkin and face painting, photo booth and refreshments. Ceramic demonstrations will be given along with tours of the new exhibit, Dealer's Choice. Work from artists will also be featured in an online auction. Arttoberfest happens Saturday, October 15th at 1401 Kearns Boulevard. The Kimball Arts Center is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
And good morning. It's 10:45, and thanks for joining us. For Utah Politics Now, I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Renee Bodley. Well, 20 of Utah's 29 counties began using the vote-by-mail system in June's primary. It was a new experience for us here in Summit County, something that Wasatch County had started during last year's election. Next week, county clerks will begin mailing out more than 900,000 ballots for the November 8th general election.
On the phone with us this morning to get the lowdown about vote by mail is Mark Thomas, State Elections Director. Good morning, Mark. Can you hear us?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Let's start with the most pressing issue. Voters will start getting their ballots in the mail next week. They've got to fill them out and mail them back. When is the deadline? When should they get those ballots in the mailbox?
Yeah, you know, so you're right. In fact, ballots are actually starting to go out now and into next week. The clerks realized they needed a few extra days to get those out, so they started sending them out earlier. So some of you might already start receiving them. But You know, one of the issues that we saw in the last election was the question on when do those ballots need to be returned. So I'm so glad you brought that up. They do need to be postmarked, again, postmarked before Election Day. So, of course, Election Day is November 8th, and so that means to get it postmarked the day before is November 7th. And so you'll want to be sure to work with your local post office to ensure you know when that postmarking deadline is, should you wait till the very last moment. Of course, we're encouraging people to, as soon as you know who you're going to cast your ballot for, and that may be difficult this election, but to turn that in as quickly as possible.
So what went wrong in Summit County? I mean, we had longtime Representative Mel Brown lose the primary by just a couple of handfuls of votes. He says he ran his own test, and he found that even if a letter was mailed on Monday, they don't get postmarked till Tuesday in some areas of Summit County. So how do voters know when their ballot might get postmarked if they drop it off Monday?
Yeah, so and that's one of the things. You'll need to check with the post office. A lot, you know, each post office has a postmarking deadline. If you get the mailing in before that postmarking deadline, for example, Colville, I believe, is 2:30, the Colville post office. And so if as long as you got that ballot in before 2:30, it will be counted and postmarked with that day's postmarking deadline. Now, if you got it in after, then the clerk has been working with the local post office to try to identify those and get those out of the pile, but it's very difficult. So you do need to be paying attention and working with your local post office to figure out when that postmarking deadline is. Think of it the same as kind of taxes. You know, you got to get it postmarked before a certain date, and you got to make sure the post office will be doing that and postmarking those on that deadline. The other option, of course, is to just dropping it off at designated drop-off locations, or even the county clerk's office can be dropped off there, and they'll accept it.
So, Mark, we've now introduced a third party into this democratic process. We now have a post office now involved in getting our ballots in. Everyone has had a nightmare story with the U.S. Post Office. How does your office, or how can the legislature legislate this third-party action in this very important process? And then secondly, to that question, how do you make sure your vote has been received and counted?
Yeah, you know, that is some excellent questions and things that we think about all the time, because not only is it a third kind of party that's now involved, it is a big one. I mean, we're talking the U.S. postal system, which is a big kind of bureaucratic entity. And, you know, things don't change very quickly, and rules don't change very quickly. And so it is something that, you know, as we've worked with the legislature on, to make it so that counties aren't forced to go vote by mail, that when they are ready and feel comfortable, and if they want to, then they can go vote by mail. The post office has actually done a really good job over the last few years to try to make some changes that helps people administer the elections easier and for voters. So, you know, there are some definite pros to going to vote by mail, but there are some cons. And part of that, too, is, you know, what is, you know, I put in my ballot in the mail, and how do I sure that it got received and it was counted and it wasn't lost somewhere? One of the things that we've implemented on our website, thevote.utah.gov, is a ballot tracking. So you can look to see when your ballot is actually mailed. So you can say, okay, I see it was mailed to me on this date, so I can probably expect it in a couple of days. And then once you complete it and you send it back in the mail, it will show when it was received by the clerk. So then you know, okay, good, the county clerk received it. And then it will also show whether it was counted, or if it was not counted, it would give the reason why it was not counted. You know, perhaps maybe your signature was missing or something. The other thing, requirement that's in statute, is the clerks must notify the voters if for some reason it's not counted. You know, we had a few voters that, the postmark was late. We had a few voters that didn't sign. Or there was a question as to the authenticity of their signature. And so in each of those cases, the voters were notified and corrected the issue if they could.
Yeah. York City, though, a very transient area. People move all of the time. So how do we know that there's not voter fraud? I mean, if I get, you know, the ballot that belongs to the person who lived in my house last year, what's to say I just don't, you know, return it?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we do, of course, is look at each signature that comes in, and we compare it against the signature that we have on file. And so that is a careful review that is done by the clerks and the staff there. But it is something that the county clerks have to make sure that their rolls stay as clean as they can, so we're not sending out these excess ballots and having the potential for people to at least think about trying to submit additional ballots. And so it's a different kind of level of issues and concerns that you have with vote by mail. And I'm not here to tell you that it's perfect in any way. I don't think our current system that we have is perfect, but we are learning a lot. There are some benefits, but there are some issues that you have to work through as well. And that's one of them that we hear that, you know, there might be some ballots out there that people might be tempted to turn in on behalf of a friend or maybe an old housemate that used to be there. So those are things that we work on carefully.
And Mark, another concern about voter fraud. We talked to Matthew Burbank, associate professor of political science at the University of Utah last fall. He said there are a lot of groups that are expressing concern about vulnerable populations. So, for example, a senior citizen. They're at a senior citizen's home, and a party representative comes in and says, hey, I'm going to talk to you guys about vote by mail and show you how to fill out your ballot. And in effect, they end up filling out someone's ballot for them. Or we've heard from maybe some domestic violence prevention groups saying there are women or a spouse who may be subject to intimidation by another spouse on how to fill out a ballot. So with vote by mail, how do you know the person filling out the ballot is the one who did so of their own volition?
Yeah, it is difficult to know, to be honest. It is hard. We of course, train political parties and other campaigns to say you cannot be completing that ballot for them. It is a felony to do that. You can't even turn it in on someone else's behalf. You know, you can work to help them get the ballot, but that's it. But we have heard those concerns that perhaps someone head of the household might gather up all of the ballots and then be able to cast them in a certain way. Again, there are some protections with reviewing the signature that helps with that. But it is a concern that as we look towards perhaps going all vote by mail, with all 29 counties go vote by mail, looking at you know, how to try to prevent something like that or do some education and how we can probably do a better job down the road.
So one of the benefits, you know, that we're doing this is that you say we tend to see an increase in voter turnout, but is that really the case?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a few years ago, we hired several professors to look into that. Do we really get an increase in turnout? And what we found was that for smaller elections, primary elections, municipal elections, special elections, we do get a sustained increase in turnout. In the last primary election, it was the highest turnout we've had since 1994 for a primary election. All of the counties that were vote by mail were on the top of the list, where those counties that were not vote by mail were at the lower end. But we also found in our study that in a presidential election, rather, you get a little bit of an increase when you initially go vote by mail. So perhaps this go around is a kind of a first time for a lot of counties, because it's kind of a novelty effect. You know, people are talking about it and people are interested in it. But overall, over a course of 4 to 8 years, those voter turnout levels actually go back down to normal levels of what it was before. So essentially, in a presidential year, those who are going to go out and vote for president are going to do that regardless of whether they get their ballot by mail or they have to go to the polls or early voting or something. So It does help in smaller elections. Bigger elections, it doesn't in the long run.
Yeah. And it just seems like we had gotten through the whole ordeal of allowing electronic voting machines to count our votes, and now it seems like we've taken a step back. I mean, why fix something if it wasn't broken?
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I tell you, I started when we had the electronic voting machines, and that was the big deal. But I know that there's been a lot of people across the United States, not necessarily here in Utah, who have been very concerned about the security of electronic voting machines. And so a lot of the vendors have just stopped building these electronic voting machines. And so as we get now 10 years down the road since we purchased our equipment, the county clerks have to look at some other option. And really the only option out there is some sort of paper-based system. And so now we're back to the paper-based system. And, of course, with that, naturally the clerks have looked at doing the vote by mail as well to be a part of that. So, yeah, it's been an interesting transformation over the last 10 years where we made some progress with using the electronic machines, but now we're back to paper because no one else really builds touchscreen or electronic machines to vote.
So, Mark, you've been on top of the latest and greatest in voting. Do you think we'll ever get to the point where we're voting online?
You know, I do. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, particularly as, I mean, you see in this election where, you know, one of the candidates said, well, if I lose, it's because someone hacked the election equipment. And so immediately that, you know, brings all sorts of questions and concerns from voters. And I would have a difficult time saying our online voting system, you know, cannot be hacked. I mean, there's just no way I could say that and have people believe me. if all someone has to do and say is, hey, I hacked into the state system, they don't even know it. And it would be very difficult to have the voter confidence in our election results under that. And so until we can change that and people feel confident in our online system, I don't think we're going to do online voting anytime soon.
And real quick, Mark, we've got about 30 seconds left. Let's talk about the cost. Are we saving money by voting by mail?
You know, there is a little bit of cost savings. You know, we still have to buy postage, and you're sending ballots out to all voters, so it kind of offsets some of the savings. But as we go to buy new equipment down the road, there will be a substantial savings from what the cost of the electronic voting machines were, probably half as much. They originally cost about $30 million. We'll probably spend half of that as we go more towards vote by mail.
All right. We need to leave it at that. Mark Thomas is the state elections director for the Lieutenant Governor's Office. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Utah Politics Now.
Utah Politics Now is sponsored by HCVT CPAs. Located in Old Town, hcvt.com. Local programming on KPCW is brought to you by a generous grant from Summit County RapTax. Recreation, Arts, and Parks Cultural Grant supports organizations that enrich the overall quality of life for residents throughout the county.
Welcome back to Utah Politics Now on KPCW. Next Thursday at 10 a.m., we will have two candidates for Summit County Council, the Democrat Glenn Wright and Republican Tal Adair. That's next Thursday starting at 10 o'clock.
And we hope you'll see you out on Monday night at the Park City Marriott. We've got happy hour 6 to 7 p.m., free pizza, soft drinks, and birthday cake. There'll be a cash bar, and all of the candidates running for Utah State Legislature, Park City School Board, and Summit County Council will be there to answer your questions. This is Utah Politics Now here on KPCW Park City. It's 11 o'clock.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Hillary Clinton takes her presidential campaign to California today after a stop in Colorado yesterday. She's hoping to...